It's the Matt Bubala Show on 720 WGN. As you know, we've talked a lot over the last couple of years already on this show about Malaysian flight MH370, the Malaysian airliner that disappeared from radar. We can't say crashed. Well, maybe Christine will tell us otherwise. I say we can't exactly say because they don't know what happened. Pieces have been found, but it's still very much up in the air over what happened. Christine Negroni gets into that and many other airline disasters in her book, The Crash Detectives, Investigating the World's Most Mysterious Air Disasters. She joins us on the phone right now. Hey, Christine, how are you?
Hello. It's nice to be with you, Matt. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for being on with us as we were talking off the air. Christine is, we could call her one of Chicago's very own. She's not from Chicago, but she spent years here at WGN-TV covering City Hall and politics. And you're a long way from that now, aren't you? Back from the Harold Washington days, for goodness sakes.
Yes. Well, you know what? The more I learn about aviation safety, the more political I realize it is. But that's really jumping into the weeds from the get-go. Let's get back
yes,
to that,
because
that's a provocative statement to make first thing out.
Yeah, we'll circle our way around to that. Christine, you jumped into covering airline disasters. You were working, I believe, for CNN at the time when TWA Flight 800 happened. Is that right?
That's right. When I left Chicago, I joined CNN in the New York Bureau. And I'd been there many years, actually, and TWA 800 blew up on its way to Paris out of New York, and I started covering that for the network. I was assigned to that we were on it with both feet for a long time. And after, so that was 96, and then in 98, I got a contract to write a book about it, and that came out in 2000, my book about Flight 800.
Well, it's quite a first assignment covering an air aviation disaster, because there's a lot of plane crashes that maybe weren't a lot of coverage right away, but turned out to be relatively simple. That one was quite complicated, wasn't it?
It really was. And, you know, even to this day, 20 years later, there are theories, you know, alternative theories and conspiracy theories. And there's a relatively new book out that blames Hillary Clinton and the Clintons for TWA 800.
Of course,
and that's apparently selling well. So, you know, so, yeah, it's, you know, some things really live on, you know, way past their point of resolution. And obviously that's my opinion, but I did write a book about it.
Sure.
And, you know, and in my book, I talked about a design flaw on the Boeing 747, which allowed that center fuel tank of the airplane to be in an explosive state, meaning that it could explode with some frequency, more than a third of the time, actually, this tank is in an explosive state. So after the book came out and after the investigation was done, the Department of Transportation mandated that you couldn't have that happen anymore, and Boeing was ordered, and all the designers were ordered to make sure that their fuel tanks were not volatile, and that's new law, but it's not actually in practice on a lot of airplanes even to this day. But, you know, the government did recognize that this was a design problem and needed to be addressed.
So you're saying a lot of the airlines, even though by law they shouldn't, would still fly with a tank in that state of the possibility of being combustible?
I wish it were that simple to explain. The fact is that the government made regulations saying you can't fly with the fuel tanks in this explosive state this frequently, but they gave them a period of time in which to comply with the law. And over the years, because there are issues with redesign and operation and who should pay for it and how to retrofit airplanes and blah, 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 the fact is that it's not necessarily in place on, you know, not all airlines are actually doing that now. They're not in violation of the regulation, but the regulations have been expanded to give them more and more time to comply. Meanwhile, these airplanes get old and they get retired, and it's less expensive for the airlines to do it when they eventually have to do it because they've waited it out.
Yeah.
You know, like when your kid tells you, you know, I'll brush my teeth later. The next thing you know, the kid's asleep. They've been able to avoid brushing their teeth that night. It's kind of the same thing.
Well, it's kind of the same thing, except the kid's teeth don't happen to eight of them fall out in the meantime. That would be a disaster. And if one more of these planes blew up in the meantime, that would cause a lot of problems. Now, it seems that the airlines have been lucky enough that that hasn't happened. Delve into that just a little bit for me for a second, because in our house, we're a big fan of the series, what is it, on the Weather Channel, for some reason, airs this, Why Planes Go Down, I think is the name of it. And I know I've seen this one on that flight, and they do great computer simulations where they reenact these things. And I want to say it has something also to do with wires that go through that tank, right?
Yes. So you can have a fuel tank in an explosive state. Like, that's not, you know, that happens. But what protects it is that there's nothing to ignite the volatile vapors. And in the case of TWA 800 and other accidents, because TWA 800 was not unique, there had been accidents prior, there had been events prior in which fuel tanks exploded. But in the case of TWA 800, it was a sort of a double whammy. There was not only the fuel tank and a very hot, and therefore the vapors were ignitable, but there also was old wiring. And somewhere along the line, no one is exactly sure where, but there was some sort of a short circuit that allowed a spark to get into the tank, and that's what triggered the explosion. So it's two things. And in fact, all aviation accidents are this way. It's never just one thing. It's a combination of things. And in this case, with Flight 800 and the other accidents that have happened before and since, there have been a few since then in which fuel tanks have ignited. Those were that there not only was this problem with an explosive fuel tank, but there was something that shouldn't be in the tank that allowed an ignition.
Have the airlines done a good job of taking care of that? I want to say, and I apologize that I'm like trying to remember from an episode of a TV show that I saw, and I don't know how reliable we take that. But is the wiring issue been fixed where they're better insulated, or they've taken care of that part of the issue so that the wires shouldn't provide the spark anymore?
Yeah, I'm going to answer that. But first, let me tell you, you got a remarkably good memory if you remember that from a long time ago on television, because you got it right.
I think I've seen it recently, because whenever that's on in the middle of the night, we end up watching it.
Okay, well, you got it right. But the answer to your question is, yeah, there's a number of reasons why you can be a little more comfortable when you fly. One of them is what I alluded to before, which is that airlines, you know, for a number of economic reasons, airlines all around the world are choosing to buy new aircraft rather than as they used to do. They'd buy old airplanes from the United States, and you'd see them in Colombia or Brazil or, mm-hmm. you know, Ethiopia. They'd buy old airliners from U.S. carriers. But now, because there are some economic reasons, both Boeing and Airbus have been able to get loans so that these carriers in the developing world can buy new. So, you know, we don't have to worry so much about aging aircraft wiring as we did back 20 years ago. But also, and after I wrote my book, I wound up serving on an FAA rulemaking advisory committee. Even saying those words sounds like, you know, I'm putting people to sleep. But it's basically an FAA group where we discussed how to make the wiring issues safer on airplanes. And for 5 years, we looked at all sorts of how pilots operated the aircraft, how maintenance workers worked on the wiring, whether circuit breakers should be reset, or whether if a circuit breaker popped, you just leave it alone. All of these things. And so a lot of things changed as a result of TWA 800 to sort of deal with both sides of that problem, both the aging wiring and the fuel tank flammability problem.
Well, one of the big things you launched the book with, this new book that we're talking about, The Crash Detectives, is the Malaysian Airlines disappearance. Is it almost 2.5 years ago now, Christine?
Yeah, it was. It was 2014, March of 2014. So, yeah, we're coming up on two and a half years.
So 2.5 years ago, this plane disappears, and conjecture is wild. There's all sorts of reports that are all over the place for the first few days, which then allows a lot of theories to come about. And one that I embraced, I'll admit, pretty wholeheartedly for a long time was maybe this plane did land somewhere. So many different reports had such differing information, and while people said it's impossible, that couldn't have happened, you're thinking, well, how could this much have happened? Then why isn't anything else possible? So I fully kept thinking, God, maybe this plane did land somewhere, and they just have things so screwed up that we don't know. You get into a lot of very interesting theories on why this plane. So let me say first off that you go with the official, I guess the official findings that the plane did fly on for 5 hours and probably just then went down in the sea when it ran out of fuel, correct?
I think the evidence is pretty overwhelming to that. Not only was the satellite information highly reliable, and no one has disputed the satellite information, but secondarily and more convincingly, pieces of the airplane have washed up in the South Indian Ocean. So I think we can pretty much rest assured, unless somebody's planting.
Well, I was just going to say, Christine, I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be that person.
Guy. Don't
however,
be that guy. That's
however,
too much TV.
However, if they were going to go to the Great Lengths to land it somewhere else and hide everything, then they'd be smart enough to take a little bit of it apart and throw it in the ocean.
And
of course
toss
they
it
would.
In the ocean. Well, I guess you're right. I guess you're right. Maybe that's there. But, you know, I do. I also subscribe to the simple is the most likely theory,
right.
in almost everything. I mean, you know, it's who when you don't, when your kid, I'm referring back, I have four kids, so I'm referring back to my kids, but you know, they can show up at school with a pretty elaborate example of why they don't have their homework, but teachers pretty much know, you know, if you don't have your homework, the simplest is probably the best, which is you didn't do it.
All right. Well, simple does make sense. We're speaking with Christine Negroni. The book is called The Crash Detectives, Investigating the World's Most Mysterious Air Disasters. Let's take a quick break, and then let's delve a little deeper into Christine's theories on what happened with MH370 and why we can't find the thing, and if we ever will. That's next. Matt Bubala with you on 720 WGN. We're speaking with Christine Negroni. It's Matt Bubala with you here on 720 WGN. Her book is The Crash Detectives, Investigating the World's Most Mysterious Air Disasters. You can follow Christine on Twitter at C Negroni, N-E-G-R-O-N-I, at C Negroni. So we started talking about the Malaysia Airlines flight that disappeared, and the theory that you put forth, and I don't think you're the only one that's gone this way on it. I think there's so many different people looking into it. But the idea that it was, it's called hypoxia, right? Basically, the cabin loses pressure for whatever reason, maybe a leak in the fuselage, maybe something else goes wrong. And once air pressure decreases inside the airplane at 30,000 feet, it's very quick, isn't it, Christine, before people either black out or just actually lose their ability to reason. It's very interesting. You explain it in the book. And I didn't realize, I thought people just pass out. But actually, you're awake and aware for a while, not realizing that you are severely impaired. Is that how it works?
Yes, that's the case. But, you know, there's two different ways you can become hypoxic in an airplane, and they're pretty significantly different. If you get on an airliner and you take off and the pilots never do pressurize the aircraft, you're going to not feel it, you know, like the frog they put in the boiling water. But if you put the frog in the water before it starts to boil, you know, it sort of sneaks up on the frog. But, and that's the way it can happen with hypoxia. And one of the examples I talk about in my book, you know, where there was this ghost flight, happened in just that way. If that happens, you wind up feeling like, maybe you'll feel something in your ears, but you wind up feeling kind of giddy and happy and feeling all's right with the world, maybe like you're drunk. And then all of a sudden the little oxygen masks will bob down, and you might look at them and you're feeling kind of stupid about, like, what's that? And, gee, I wonder what's that? Maybe I should put that on. Well, I don't know. What should I put it on for? You know, just kind of rambling. Your mind is rambling like I am. Or you can have a different kind of depressurization, and that is when the airplane is flying along, everything tight and, you know, happy, like you're in the balloon, that life-saving balloon, and all of a sudden there's a pop, and all of that pressure races out. It's going to race out of the airplane. It's going to race out of you. So it's going to be pretty dramatic what's happened. But it is also going to be so disorienting that you may not be able to recapture your right mind. You may not, it's just going to happen too quickly. So if you put your mask on, if the oxygen masks drop and you are able to control your limbs, which is another problem with rapid onset of hypoxia, is you begin to tremble, your hands and feet. You put your mask on, you might get enough oxygen to start feeling a little bit better, but you know, you're going to know something's wrong, but you'll be kind of dopey. That's the kind of hypoxia that happened on Malaysia 370 in the scenario I discuss in my book.
So on a regular flight, if there's depressurization, if something happens very quickly and there's depressurization, those masks automatically are supposed to fall from the ceiling. I imagine they do. We have about 12 seconds from depressurization till our brain is going to start having issues, correct? We have about 12 seconds of clear thought before things really start going haywire. Is there generally, would you say, on an airplane where this happens, enough time for people to realize, oh, something went wrong, I better put this on?
If there's a sudden and rapid decompression, you're not going to have as much as 12 seconds because all the air that you have inside of you is mm-hmm. going to rush out of you. There's no holding your breath in a rapid decompression. You've gone from 6,000, which is the altitude, or 8,000, the altitude inside the airplane, to 35,000. That's sudden, dramatic, and you're not going to be able to hold your breath. So your brain is going to be pretty immediately starved of oxygen. And 15 seconds is about the most you've got. And that is not going to be in your right mind. That's going to be in your very startled and disoriented mind. If you're, on the other hand, if you're in the kind of airplane in which the plane fails to pressurize, you have much longer because your body is, you know, a little bit acclimated, and you're not going to have, you're not going to go from 6,000 feet to 35 in a heartbeat. You're going to go from 6,000 or 8,000 feet to 12,000 feet, which is about the time the masks start to drop. The masks will drop at 10,000 to 12,000 feet when the cabin reaches 10,000 to 12,000 feet. Mm-hmm. If the airplane continues to ascend, you're going to be in big trouble.
Unless you have that mask on.
Unless you have that mask on, that's correct.
So when we're talking about the Malaysian Airlines flight, MH370, it couldn't have been, didn't depressure on takeoff because they were in the air for quite a while before anything went wrong. So we ruled that out right away, right?
Correct.
So they're in midair. Let's assume that there's a rapid depressurization. Do you think that most if the masks fall as they're supposed to, would you say that in general most people, like you describe how quickly things go awry in your body, do you think most people, and do they have studies that show whether or not most people in these situations get the masks on, or are they so out of it so quickly and so startled that before they can realize, oh, I need to put this on, they're out of it and they don't end up doing it?
I'm going to say that there's probably a number of people who would not have been able to put their masks on at all. Either they were asleep when the event happened. Remember, this was a red-eye flight.
Right.
So they were asleep when it happened. The second would be there might have been people up and walking around when it happened, in which case they would, you know, they'd have probably be, you know, falling to the floor or whatever with these spasms, with these muscle spasms. You know, you have to be able to reach up, grab the mask when a lot of other stuff is going on. Wind, tremendous cold, because the temperature outside is something in the order of 40 to 60, minus 40 to 60 degrees Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of other stuff going on. The cabin becomes full of this mist from the cold air freezing the moisture in the air inside the cabin. So I'm not giving that a high likelihood that too many people put their masks on and then sort of watched and waited for what happened. I think that, you know, pretty much people were put out of it.
The interesting thing, I know that there's one flight I think you talk about in this book, or maybe I read about another book. No, I think you did, because you get into the Payne Stewart flight and another flight that I think ended up crashing into a mountain that was kind of the same thing, where there was depressurization, seemed like everybody was knocked out, but they believe that somebody in the back, probably a flight attendant, had a mask on and eventually made their way up to the front, right?
Yes, and that's the accident on which I based the Malaysia 370 scenario, that accident. That's the Helios Flight 522.
Okay, so in that situation, so anybody who's sitting in a seat that puts this mask on, unless they pressurize, unless the pilots are able to bring that flight back down, somebody in their seat is not going to be able to do anything, right? Because you have to be in your seat to have that mask on. You take that mask off. At 35,000 feet in a depressurized cabin, you never make it up to the cockpit to help anybody out, right?
That's correct. And the person who did, in the case of Helios 522, which I discuss at great length in my book, because of it's the likelihood that Malaysia 370 was another of that kind of an accident, he was a flight attendant. And flight attendants have portable oxygen bottles that they can use. And in this case, I believe there were three or four of them. I don't remember exactly. But at the wreckage scene, there were three or four of these portable oxygen bottles found, and it was believed that that's how this flight attendant got up into the cockpit. So in this case, should I just explain that, what happened?
Let's do that, because I want to get, that's a whole separate flight, but yeah, let's talk about it. In fact, let's take a quick break. We're up against the news here. Let's take a quick break. We're speaking with Christine Negroni. She's the author of The Crash Detectives, Investigating the World's Most Mysterious Air Disasters. Helios Flight 522, she'll tell us about, because this is one where there was depressurization and they flew for a long time, and she'll tell us about it. But I believe, fighter pilots actually got to get up and see the plane and see kind of what they could see through the windows of what was going on before it did crash, just like with the Payne Stewart flight. flight, and that relates to Christine's theory on Malaysian flight MH370. We'll talk about that after the news next here on 720 WGN. The Matt Bubala Show on Radio 720 WGN. We're speaking with Christine Negroni, the book The Crash Detectives, investigating the world's most mysterious air disasters. Of course, a lot of the book about MH370, the Malaysian flight that we still haven't found. But Christine gets into a lot of the world's famous air disasters, some that we've heard a lot about, some we haven't heard very much about. Helios Flight 522 is one that Christine was starting to tell us about before the news that relates to MH370. So, Christine, I'll give the short setup. Here's a flight that's in the air, rapid decompressurization, everybody knocked out. But a flight attendant in the back eventually makes their way up towards the front. Christine, they know this, I believe. Well, some of it, I'm sure, from the wreckage, but some because did fighter jets get to, or somehow somebody, this plane was flying along so long off course that they knew something was wrong, and did fighter jets get alongside of it? Is that how they kind of saw what was going on in the plane?
Yes, and to be clear, this plane was the opposite of off course. It was flying on autopilot exactly as it would have flown had the pilots been conscious. But in this case, they failed to pressurize the aircraft when they took off. So at 12,000 feet, the masks dropped. But the pilots, rather than put their masks on, tried to figure out what went wrong. And so they were diagnosing the problem when they both passed out. You know, that's why, you know, everybody, mask first, just like the flight attendant says. So, you know, about 2 hours later, the Greek fighter pilots, who were basically thinking that this plane has been hijacked, like 9/11
yeah.
style, they're flying alongside this plane on autopilot, and they see this young man enter the cockpit. He's the flight attendant, but he also just, by luck, I guess, happened also to be a pilot in training, a general aviation pilot. So he comes into the cockpit, and he sits down in the captain's seat. The captain's not in his seat because he passed out. He was at the instrument panel behind his seat when he went unconscious. So the flight attendant gets into the captain's seat, and he puts on the mask, and now he's trying to radio a mayday, but he doesn't do it correctly. And that, you know, that mayday is only recorded on the cockpit voice recorder, but it never gets transmitted outside the airplane. The Greek pilots are motioning him to follow them, you know, best hope, I guess, that he can figure out how to do it, but he can't. And the fuel, 7 minutes later, both of the engines run out of fuel and the plane crashes.
Ugh.
But he's clearly the last person alive on that flight. And, you know, he is an example of, you know, sort of the limitation. The passengers are not going to live longer than 15 minutes in an airplane without oxygen because without sufficient oxygen, because those masks only have emergency oxygen. They don't have it for a whole flight. And that's, you know, that's sort of the tragedy there. But I had written about that accident quite extensively at the time that ABC News asked me to help them with their coverage of Malaysia 370. So in the second and third week, when this whole story about the plane flying on with no apparent manipulation of the aircraft after this 5 hour period or after this 2 hour period, I started thinking, this sounds like Helios to me. And so that's why in my book I put this scenario together. The more I researched about the aircraft, about the Malaysia flight, the maintenance of the oxygen, the crew oxygen right before the flight, you know, this 5 hour period in which the plane never moved off course, the more it looked to me like Malaysia 370. Significant differences, of course,
sure,
but mostly it looked a lot like it.
Well, I want to ask a couple more quick questions about Helios 522. One is, the pilots, you believe, assessed instead of putting their masks on, or I guess crash scene evidence indicates they never put masks on. Why aren't pilots trained that as soon as there's an indicator of depressurization or the need to use the mask, why are they, because you theorize that this probably happened in MH370 possibly, is that they started working out what went wrong instead of getting a mask on right away. Why wouldn't the pilots be trained that as soon as there's any indication to wear oxygen mask, get it on before you do anything else?
That's right. They are trained to do that. And so what you and everyone else has a very difficult time understanding, especially other pilots, is that they didn't do the thing they were trained to do. But here's the explanation, as far as I'm concerned, it really answers it, is that they were already mentally compromised. Because remember, the masks drop at 10 to 12,000 feet. Okay, that's not like flying, that's not like, you know, being in Mount Everest, of course. But they were already starting to lose their mental edge. And in this case, both of these pilots were smokers, which makes them even less able to deal with a deprivation of oxygen. So they were already making judgment errors. And we know they were making judgment errors because not only did they not put on their masks and they were diagnosing the problem, but they failed to recognize the problem, and we know that because in their conversations with the ground with their ground operations staff, they didn't understand that they were getting an oxygen pressurization problem. They didn't even understand that.
We're talking about Helios or MH370?
In Helios.
In Helios, okay.
In
Helios. So they were both smokers and they didn't
Yes. Okay. They were compromised. They were already, and I'm putting air quotes around it, they were already stupid because
right.
of the lack of oxygen.
And that's
the thing. Everyone thinks, well, pilots wouldn't have done that. They'd have put on their mask. Well, yes, they would have if they were in their right mind.
Right. So,
but the problem is first manifest in the fact that you're not in your right mind.
The flight attendant who's in the back, who clearly kept himself alive on oxygen tanks, but it was 2 hours later before he made his way to the front. Why do you think that happened?
Well, that is, to me, a very big mystery, and I can only imagine that he also was compromised. Even though he had oxygen, he was getting oxygen, this plane was flying, you know, I don't remember exactly, but 32, it was flying at cruise altitude, it was flying high. And so maybe he was also slightly compromised, or just, you know, paralyzed. I mean, just with normal fear. Here's a 25-year-old kid on an airplane. He knows the pilots ought to be taking it down. They're not. Maybe there was a hierarchy issue, like, what am I? I'm a flight attendant. These guys must know what they're doing. You know, any number of reasons. But, yes, had he gone in sooner, things might have ended differently.
Yeah, that's very interesting and very scary to think about, that he waited that long. And so you wonder, was he just in a fog? Did he not know what to do? Was he told never to come up to the cockpit unless it's an emergency? I mean, the plane was on autopilot, so it was flying normal. It probably wasn't shaking or doing anything crazy, right? It was probably flying as normal as it can, except for the mask being down and people not having the oxygen they should.
Right, but he had to look around and see that everyone on the airplane was passed out.
Yeah, yeah. Have you read Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers book?
I have.
So he details a lot in there. You mentioned the hierarchy problem, and that was one of the things he detailed in his book about, I forget which airline it was, but one of the Eastern Airlines where the pilot is always in charge and you never question him, and accidents that had actually happened because the second-in-command, third-in-command knew that they were going to crash but were hesitant to actually make a change when the pilot thought he knew what he was doing. And so I wonder, when you say that, Neil, maybe they're trained, you don't come up front until whatever, whatever, and eventually, you know, between the fog and everything else, maybe that's when he goes. So let's jump over to MH370 then. We don't know. Let me ask you, how much do we actually know? You write in the book that a lot of what's come public, we don't know all the facts that they actually do know, that there's actually more rich detail from just the pings and what they have been able to gather than what we had before. And that's what you've used to put your theory together on what happened. Tell me, what do we exactly know right now versus what we're trying to figure out?
Well, we know about the maintenance issue with the oxygen in the cockpit. We know that the crew oxygen was serviced right before the flight. The oxygen bottles were repressurized. So they were reinstalled into the cockpit, and then the connection between the tanks and the masks was then again reset. So we know, you know, that issues arising from the mask and the tanks are possible because they're, you know, because they were worked on right before.
And you write in the book that's an issue that happens where mechanics repressurize the tank, make sure the tank's filled and pressurized, but there is a basically you have to turn a knob to open it up so that the pressure is going to be full, right? And if they don't do that, and there's not a great checklist for that, they have to remember to do that at the end. If they only turn it a quarter turn instead of fully opening it, not enough oxygen is going to come through the mask to actually keep the person coherent, right?
Yes, and that's on some airliners, because some airlines, recognizing this problem, have added new tests to the, you know, for the captain and the first officer to do to make sure that the pressure is on full. But not all airlines have done that, and we don't know. So now we're getting into what we don't know. Yeah. We don't know whether Malaysia Airlines did that. But the other thing about, you know, what we know and what we don't know that it's very important to understand is, and I'm a big advocate for this. There's great discussion about finding the black boxes, and that's why all these millions of dollars have been spent, you know, looking for where this airplane is. It's the boxes they're after.
Right.
But the fact is, when you say that's the only thing that's going to tell us what happened, you really do allow the mystery to continue, and there are other rich sources of information on the ground. The history, the maintenance history of that airplane, the crew, you know, the issues involving the crew and the crew performance, the crew evaluations, this radar and the operation of the satellite and the radar and the radios. Were there any problems with these radios? These things would be on the ground, and we don't know because the Malaysians have been very quiet about what they're finding out. In the United States, factual information like that comes up during an investigation is released. It's public, and that's the National Transportation Safety Board, and they've been criticized for doing it, but they will come out and they will release this information to journalists and others working on, you know, on trying to find out what happened. But that is not the way it's being handled in Malaysia, and that is in contravention to international civil aviation organization guidelines for how an investigation should be handled. So they're keeping things quiet. They're keeping things secret. They shouldn't be doing it. And worse than that, they're using the inability to find the black boxes as a dodge to say they'll never know what happened until they get the boxes. And I would not accept that as fact.
We're speaking with Christine Negroni. The book is The Crash Detectives. So now we're getting heavy into it. MH370. Not a lot of information is being released as it should. As Christine is saying, information you should have despite not having the black boxes. We'll find out what that information possibly could be and what Christine thinks about the search for MH370 after this. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. The Matt Bubala Show on 720 WGN. We're speaking with Christine Negroni, the book The Crash Detectives. As we went into the break, Christine, you were saying that the Malaysian authorities haven't been as good as, say, the NTSB would be about releasing what information has been found out. And you said that you can piece together pretty well a lot of things that happened or could have happened with data that's not found on the black boxes from everything else that we do have. So what types of things could Malaysia maybe have found out by now that they're not telling us, or what things do you think they should be studying until the black boxes are hopefully found?
Well, one of the most intriguing things that happened on this airplane was a loss of power around the time that everything else happened. So when this airplane radioed in or made its last electronics call to the ground, which is on something called the ACARS. Basically, it's the plane doing a self-diagnostic, and it does it every half an hour.
Is this
on Malaysia.
Is this the handshake, the ping that we heard so much about with the satellite?
That's different. This is just like a if you scheduled your phone to every half an hour tell you where it was. It's kind of like that. Airlines have scheduled their airplanes to report in with certain kinds of information every half hour. And in Malaysia's case, it was every half hour. The airlines can do it at whatever frequency they want. In the case of Malaysia, it was every half hour. It radioed in at 107 or transmitted in at 107 this information. The next scheduled time for it to download was therefore at 137. That didn't happen. So sometime before 137 and sometime after 120, which was when the pilots made their last call to the ground, sometime in that period, something happened. There was a loss of power. We don't know what, and I think that's the depressurization. But there was also a loss of power to the airplane, and it didn't come back until 221. How do we know this? We know this because now let's get to the satellite. Your phone is pinging the nearest tower near you when it's on every X period of time. I don't know how often. And it's saying, hello, cell tower. I'm here on Main Street. Airplanes do the same thing to the satellite. They say, hello, satellite, I'm powered on, I'll talk to you in an hour. And they do that every hour. If they don't do that, it's because they're not powered on. This airplane failed to say, hello, I'm powered on, until 2:20-ish. I'm working from my memory here. It's in the book. Until about that time, when all of a sudden, it powered on. And it didn't just say, hello, satellite. It said, hello, satellite, I'm signing on for the day. It made a different kind of signal, not just a hello, but a hello, I'm logging on to the system. And the only reason it would log on to the system is if it had logged off of the system, if power had been cut. Now, why does an airplane lose total power? That's bizarre. Well, that doesn't happen. And so the question is why?
And what do you mean by total power? So let's go back into the book. So you write, loss of regular transmissions from the plane to the satellite sometime between 107 and 137 with the return of the signal at 2:25 a.m.
Good. So, I'm glad you're reminding me of those numbers.
Sure. So for about an hour, it didn't check in or when it should have, right?
That's correct.
It didn't check in.
Correct.
Now, when you say it lost total power, all engines shut off, what do we mean by lost total power?
No, what I mean is that there was the satellite, the communication with the satellite stopped. And the only reason for that would be if the plane was upside down and it couldn't communicate with the satellite because the antenna was no longer facing the satellite, upwards, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
If there was some sort of a software problem, and I don't know more about that other than this is one of the ways I'm told that it would stop communicating with the satellite,
mm-hmm.
or if it had lost power. In other words, for the antenna to transmit to the satellite, it needs a power source. Like, your phone is not going to make calls if it's turned off,
right.
If it's powered off. So somewhere, somehow, the power to the satellite data unit turned off and then turned back on again. The question is why, and I don't think, and here's why this is also important. Why would this happen? It's very unusual, unless this was part of some larger issue.
So
and that's why they couldn't use the radio, and that's why ACARS disappeared. That's the larger question.
So is it possible on a plane like this for power to shut off and then come back on, or an auxiliary unit to power something back up? Are there backup systems?
It's possible that there had been a loss of power that turned off the satellite data unit, but we're not talking about a loss of engine power. It's not that the plane was not powered, because if the plane were not powered, it would start to descend if the engine stopped turning. The engines were turning just fine. They're just using fuel, and they're turning like a proper machine. It's not electrical power there. It's actually the engines are actually generating the electrical power. But in the course of my trying to get to the bottom of why did the satellite turn off, I found another accident, an event. I use the accident. There was no accident because nothing catastrophic happened and no one was injured. But in 2008, a Qantas 747 was on approach to Bangkok, and on its way down to the ground, it lost power to the aircraft, not the engines. They're still turning. The airplane is fine landing,
mm-hmm.
but the power was lost. And when they went to find out why, they discovered that water had come into the electronics bay, which is located in the lower level of the aircraft, below a kitchen that's used for the business class part of the airplane. And that water drained into the electronics bay, and it caused a short circuit. So they found this out, and turns out, I learned, I guess not unusual for in the aircraft investigation world, but I learned that's not so uncommon for water to get into this bay. So I contacted the Australians, and I said, in the process of learning about this power failure, did you look and see whether power to the satellite was lost? Because then you see, if they had discovered that, we'd know, okay, here's an explanation for why this happened to Malaysia 370.
Mm-hmm.
But the Australians never investigated that.
Can they go back and find that out, or if
you're damn tootin' they can? Why haven't they?
Well,
that's the question.
Why haven't they?
I don't know.
They won't answer that.
But they won't answer why they won't. And the Malaysians don't speak to me at all. Don't answer any of my questions. But that's irrelevant. Now you see. So now you're seeing there are facts on the ground. You can say this happened to this airplane, and on the 777, the galley, the kitchen, is located above the electronics bay, just as it is on the 747. So we know the mechanism for causing a short circuit and a loss of power exists. So you'd want to know, could it have happened on Malaysia 370? And that's the kind of facts I'm talking about. It's not completely unknowable. We don't know what we won't know until we try and find out what we do know.
Yeah. So they might know a lot of this stuff, but they're not sharing that information.
Correct.
We're speaking.
And I'll tell you, they can't, you know, unless Australia's lying to me. Australia told me they didn't look. So if the Malaysians asked them, in other words, what you said is, maybe they know and they're not telling us.
Mm-hmm.
Australia said they never looked. Not they never looked for me. They never looked at all.
Mm-hmm.
So unless the Malaysians came to them after I asked this question, they didn't look even for the Malaysians. And this was a year and a half afterwards. Why?
Is it possible they just didn't think about that? Or is that silly to think because we're covering everything? We're spending hundreds of millions of dollars searching for a plane. Of course,
exactly.
They're looking at everything.
I've got to make that assumption. I mean, I'm an aviation writer. I'm a pretty smart cookie. But come on. I'm the only person in the world who thought of this? I don't think so. That's the question.
Christy,
or did they just not care? I don't know.
All right, I've got to keep you for one more segment because this leads into, you know, you're dismissing certain theories of the black helicopter among us who want to say it landed in the stands, right? But at the same time, when you're saying things like this, it leads to other speculation and questions and other crashes that you bring up in the book that there sometimes are political issues involved with these things where certain information wants to be protected. So is it an issue where maybe it's not a nefarious deed by the pilots or somebody on board, but maybe we're not finding out as much as we can because certain people want to make sure that only the information they want out gets out? We'll do a little more with Christine Negroni. The Crash Detectives is the book. You can find her at ChristineNegroni.com, and the book is well worth the read. I highly recommend it. A little more with Christine after the news here on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you on 720 WGN. A little bit more with Christine Negroni. The book is The Crash Detectives, Investigating the World's Most Mysterious Air Disasters. And Christine, as we're headed into the news, you're mentioning that there's information maybe that could be had, maybe that is had that isn't being shared, or maybe that hasn't been found for whatever reason. And you talk in the book about a few different crashes where there was probably a lot more information that could be found that for whatever reason was not quickly descended upon. An accident, I forget which one because you cover a lot of different air disasters in the book, but there was one that involved a bunch of American servicemen who were coming home for Christmas. This crash happens, and we don't get nearly as involved as you would expect we do. And answers for a long time aren't found. And actually, the widow of somebody on board, I believe it is, and I forget which country this is in, the crash was up on a mountain, but she hires a guide and she goes up to the mountain herself to see the accident and the wreckage, and then goes on, I think, the Today Show or Good Morning America to call out the NTSB on what the hell are we doing. I went up there and saw the wreckage, and nobody from that should be up there has gone up there to see this yet. So are there instances, I guess you're saying there are, where sometimes there's a crash that maybe not everybody involved wants all the information to come out, either to cover their own shortcomings or maybe sometimes because there were political ramifications of something. Does that tie into MH370 at all?
Well, there's the question. I mean, my default mechanism is to say I think there's probably a lot more done by blundering than by purposeful manipulation. But sometimes blundering gets you to a point where you then have to purposely manipulate to cover the fact that you bumbled. And I don't think government officials are above that. In fact, I think looking at history, we can see that government has done that quite a bit. And I don't just mean that government. I mean our government. I mean governments in general. Tend to do that. So in the case of the two accidents you talked about, which were both American carriers with Americans on board that killed Americans, the accident, neither one of those accidents were investigated by the Americans. And what's interesting about that is under ICAO guidelines, ICAO is the International Civil Aviation Organization, under their guidelines, the country in which it occurs does the investigation. So in these two cases, which I talk about in the Crash Detectives, one was Canada and the other was Bolivia. Now, I don't know what our relationship was with Bolivia at the time. I get the impression from my research that it was somewhat tense. But in the case of the Canadians, we've always had a very good relationship with the Canadians. And this accident happened with American servicemen on board, and the Americans basically stood around and watched the Canadians bungle the investigation. And, you know, the research I've done and the other book that has been written about that particular accident, and ABC News 2020 did a two-part series on this, just shows incompetence and bungling. Why would the Americans not step in there and say, listen, let us help out. Let us loan you our technical people. Granted, Canada doesn't have as much commercial aviation as America. Maybe their safety board wasn't as experienced as America's. Go in and help them as a silent partner or as a technical advisor. There's nothing in the ICAO guidelines that tells countries they can't do that. In fact, it does happen. So America didn't do that. Why? There's some reason to believe that there might have been things on board the airplane that the American military knew about and didn't declare. There's some indication that maybe soldiers were bringing ordnance with them, souvenirs from their time in combat on the airplane. But there's lots of evidence to believe that the airplane had some sort of fire or explosion before it hit the ground, and the Canadians said that icing on the wings caused the crash. Now, icing on wings can cause a crash, but it doesn't cause an explosion, not in flight. So that, you know, that's where you look at it and you say nothing about this investigation makes sense. And at the end of the day, the Canadians were so bungling in the way they handled this investigation that a judge finally said neither one of the theories you've put out here, either the explosion on board or the ice on the wings, neither one of them is credible. And we're just going to call it quits to the whole investigation. We'll never know what happened. This is what happens in an air accident investigation in a first world country with Americans on board. I don't know. I think it smells.
And where is the state of that right now? Is it just a dead investigation?
It's a dead investigation. It's in my book. But, I'd love to think that my book will reopen it, but I'm not so sure I have that kind of power.
You mentioned earlier that there's a book out right now that blames the Clintons for TWA Flight 800, right? So in your book, you mention a few flights like this sort of, or accidents like this during the Reagan years that maybe, and while they were going through the Iran-Contra thing, so there's some other investigations that maybe didn't get the treatment you would expect them to get. Could MH370 have something like this? I mean, is there any reason to believe there was either cargo on board that's weird or somebody on board that was suspicious? Or is it just Malaysia, as you also mentioned in the book, maybe they're not doing as much as they should, spending as much money. This is a government-controlled airline. So if there's shortcomings in how they're running their flights or shortcuts they're taking, maybe they don't want all of that becoming public.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have to say that it's entirely possible, and I think probably likely, that the Malaysians bungled the investigation in the beginning. And again, I mean, we say the Canadians don't have maybe a lot of experience investigating major air accidents because they don't have that many major airlines, but the Malaysians have even less. I mean, they just don't have a robust aviation safety investigation agency because they don't need it. So, or they didn't need it. So it's, you know, it could just be that. I was in Malaysia for 5 weeks and they still hadn't come up with organizing an investigation body. So they had to create one for the event. So that will show you how behind the ball they were. So it could just be simple bungling. But, the other thing you have to keep in mind, and they always say this when you're doing reporting, is follow the money. Follow the money. Who's making money on Malaysia 370 at this point? And that's the people who are searching the ocean for it. That's where the money's being spent. So a lot of money is being spent on what is likely a quixotic effort to find not just an airplane, but a teeny-weeny little box inside an airplane. We don't even know where the airplane is. Now we got to find the box. It's miles below. It's not like a swimming pool. This is the ocean.
Right.
When people say, well, why haven't they found it? Something mysterious happened. Have you seen the ocean lately? And
it's
not
a little
just
bit.
The ocean, but a big one, a big deep one in the middle of nowhere.
Well,
so that's where they're spending money. They're spending money on the least likely thing to give them illumination, as opposed to on the ground, which is there's not a lot of money to be made going through maintenance records and doing interviews with people.
But who's, well, you know, so the company that's doing the searching is making the money, but it's still costing everybody who's giving that money a lot of money. So do they want to spend it where they know it's the most futile? So to me, it's not who's making the money, it's who's spending the money. And why aren't they demanding more for their dollar? So is it because they're okay with not getting the answers they want or people want?
I think sometimes governments want to show that they're doing something, so they throw money at it, because then you can say you're doing everything you can.
I mean, finding the black boxes, though, while it's the toughest part of this investigation, and you mentioned everything else you could find out if you did, the investigative reporting on everything else, the radio signals, the people on the ground, the people that saw the plane, everything else. The black box would give you the most definitive answers, though, right? I mean, if they could find that, the percentage of really knowing what happened is greater than anything else, is it not?
50% of that is correct. The cockpit voice recorder is extremely unlikely to yield anything because it tapes over every 2 hours. So the critical period on the cockpit voice recorder would be that time when the airplane went from having a normal flight to China to turning around and heading back to Kuala Lumpur. That's the important period of time, and that happened hours earlier. So that no longer exists if someone entered the cockpit and said, okay, hands up, I'm taking over the airplane. Or if one pilot said to the other, hey, we're going to bring this thing into the South Indian Ocean, whatever. That's what you'd need. So 50% of the boxes I don't think is going to be illuminating at all. The flight data recorder could be illuminating, yes, if it recorded something interesting happening at that period of time earlier on. So that's, yes, helpful if we can get it. No question about it.
So many airlines are, and let's go through real quick because I don't think we've exactly finished the whole thing. What do you think happened? What's your theory on what happened on MH370?
Well, the plane was flying at 35,000 feet, which is a perfectly fine, low workload level of flight. They were needing the crew needed to hand over, change over from the airspace of Malaysia to the airspace of Vietnam. They'd been given the frequency to enter into the transponder so that they would now be identifying themselves to Vietnam air traffic control. The captain left the cockpit. Now, before I start, I just want to say to you right now, this is now my speculation.
Do we know that the captain left the cockpit? We don't know that 100% for sure. Okay.
We do not know that. We do know that, though the captain had been flying for the first period of time, he had turned over control of the aircraft for the last radio call. And we know that because the way it is traditionally done in the cockpit, the pilot flying is not the pilot on the radio.
Okay.
So in the early part of the flight, the pilot flying was the captain and the first officer was making the calls. But the last call, Goodnight Malaysia 370, came from the captain, which means the first officer was flying.
And that, so theoretically, now it's the right time. We've turned it over. He's in control. We've made our last call we have to make for a while. This would be the time where he would get up to use the washroom if that was something he was going to do. It makes sense, at least theoretically, that he would have exited the cockpit at this time.
Full credits to the fact that this is a theory.
Sure.
The captain leaves the cockpit. He goes to the bathroom. The first officer is flying the airplane. This is not a challenge, even though he was very inexperienced on this aircraft. He was still not qualified to fly it. He was on a qualification flight. So he's flying the airplane. Something happens. Some rapid decompression. The first thing he does at this time of decompression is reaches over with a spasmodic arm to the transponder to enter the emergency frequency to let everybody know he's got an emergency. He has to dial 7700. Rather than doing that, he turns the transponder to standby because he's having difficulty controlling his limbs. That's completely consistent with hypoxia. He then puts his mask on. He's getting some oxygen, and this is the second failure. In the replacement of the tanks, the the oxygen to the mask was not set properly, and rather than get full 100% oxygen under pressure, which he would need at that altitude to rejuvenate his mind, he was getting less than that. He was getting enough oxygen to remain conscious, but not enough to make intelligent decisions. He turns the airplane around because he's got an emergency, and he starts heading back. He enters into the flight management system nearest emergency airport. He hits execute. That helps the airplane turn around. In fact, the airplane is in control. It turns around, and it heads back towards Kuala Lumpur, towards Penang, which would have been one of the emergency airports programmed in there. At this point, the radar shows, and the radar is not, again, I mean, I'm saying this is my theory of speculation,
right,
but the radar that we are using this as a factual account is not as factual as it would appear. It is a guess about this being the airplane, but there are many who believe maybe it was and maybe it wasn't. It's a little hard to say because there was no identification information being transmitted by the airplane because the transponder was off. But in any event, the plane flies back across the peninsula. It starts to go north. It starts to go west. It starts to go south. That's the last anybody sees of it. But we know it flew for more than five hours after that, because it continued to pass along those handshakes to the satellite. Hi, I'm here. Hi, I'm here. Hi, I'm here.
So he programs in to get it towards the next emergency airport. What happens? Why does it overshoot that?
Because I think he took control of it at that point. I think he thought, oh, wait, Penang? No, I'm going to go to Langkawi. Why Langkawi? It's got a longer runway by 2,000 feet, and he knew it intimately.
Mm-hmm.
But anything he did, from the moment that plane turned around, anything the first officer did cannot be explained logically because he no longer had logic. And when you look at the flight plan and what happened, not flight plan, but when you look at the route that the airplane took, assuming the radar is accurate, it's illogical. So to me, if you're trying to look at an accident and figure out why is there this crazy flight at ending in a complete non-interrupted flight until it runs out of fuel, that says to me, hypoxic flight, ghost flight.
So if he got the mask on but it wasn't getting the proper pressurization of oxygen, maybe it gives him enough oxygen to think, well, I've got my mask on, I know what I'm doing. And so he keeps making decisions while he's getting enough oxygen to keep him awake. You don't realize that you're not getting enough oxygen. You think you're doing great, as you illustrate in the book. There have been tests done on hypoxia, and people think that they absolutely know what they're doing, maybe even think that they're smarter, like really doing well, when they're really making mistake after mistake after mistake and having no clue that they're doing it, right?
Yes. In my mind, this first officer thought he was going to land that airplane and be a hero.
Yeah. And if the actual pilot is in the bathroom, something happens. We're assuming if it happens catastrophically, there's probably an explosion, not an explosion like hole in the plane necessarily, but if it happens really rapidly at 35,000 feet, would everybody know it right away? Like there was some popping in your ear or something where you're like, oh my God, something just happened?
Much more than that. Much more than just a popping in your ear. It's like a balloon popping. All that pressure, I mean, there's pounds and pounds. I think if it's an 8,000-foot pressurization, if the cabin is pressurized to 8,000 feet, there's 8 pounds of pressure on every inch of the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of force. If there's some sort of breach in the fuselage of that airplane, that is going to blow all that air out because it's under that kind of force. And that air is going to race out of the cabin.
Mm.
And it's going to race out of everyone's bodies as well.
So,
like a punch in the gut, much more dramatic.
So if the captain himself is in the bathroom, very dramatic, he's got, as we would say, a few seconds of coherent thought to get himself back to the cockpit. It's very likely that you never make it back to the cockpit necessarily, right? Because you lose the pressure so fast, you lose your senses so fast that in the bathroom, I'm guessing.
And motor function in his case, because he's presumably standing up.
Yeah.
He's, trying to get back, and you don't have motor function.
And does a mask drop in the bathroom?
Yes.
But you can't
yes.
take it with you. So if he leaves the bathroom, he's got to take it off. And even though it's just a few steps, that 5 seconds would be severely affected, right?
Yes, and plus physical exertion. So let's say he's in the bathroom, the mask drops, he says, holy smokes, I got to get out of here. And he, you know, heart begins to beat, obviously, limbs trembling. He's trying to control his physical state in a moment of complete physical mayhem. If he gets the bathroom door open, if he can control his limbs to the extent that he's going to get out the bathroom and up the hall to the cockpit, if he can do that, his physical exertion is going to take away even the 15 seconds he would have had he been seated in a seat as the first officer was.
Hmm.
He's going to have less ability to manage.
So
he never got back to the cockpit.
So if we go with this theory that this is what happened, and it makes sense because, you know, the flight continued on. It ran as far as possible, as far as they know. So there was, you know, there was an early report of it ascended, it descended, did all these things. They've ruled that out because it couldn't have traveled as far as it did had all that happened, because that would have burned a lot of fuel, right?
Right.
So theoretically, all this happens. I would think that, you know, the only way, I'm guessing the only way this could ever be proved, though, is by finding the actual airplane, right? And seeing what these nozzles were set at on the oxygen bottles and things like that. Is there any other way to prove it? I guess the only other way they could theoretically say, yeah, this is likely what happened, is looking at other Malaysian airline planes that these mechanics worked on and testing their nozzles and saying, God, these guys never set these nozzles correctly, or something like that. Is there ever...
Yeah, whether they had had previous events.
Yeah.
Certainly you could interview the mechanics who had worked on the airplane. You could take a look of whether, as you said, whether there had been problems like this before. What was the history with this particular aircraft and the oxygen, both bottles and masks? You know, part of the problem is not necessarily, or part of the theory is not necessarily that is the reason that he wasn't getting full oxygen. There can be problems with the mask. Perhaps they installed it correctly, but the mask was in some way compromised. There's a little bellows-like device in the mask that tells the mask, hey, we're at 35,000 feet, give this guy 100% oxygen. That's not, you know, that's a default position, but if there's something wrong with that little aneroid, then that won't happen either. And so the connection could have been fine, but the mask could have been creating a problem.
So all sorts of things could have gone wrong, but we'll never really know any of it for sure, am I right? Unless we find that airplane and they can prove from what they find, and that's assuming that the airplane gets found in somewhat intact and certain pieces aren't completely destroyed and they're able to find everything, which is extremely unlikely, I would guess, because this didn't crash on a mountain where everything is somewhere. This is in the sea somewhere where it could have been destroyed upon impact and then scattered for miles and miles. So even if they find the wreckage, the likelihood of finding everything they need from the wreckage, I imagine, is pretty minimal, right?
Here, and you know, here's the interesting thing. Will you ever know for 100% sure what happened to Malaysia 370? I'd put money on the fact that we won't. But considering we had another airliner have a ghost flight, killing everyone on board, and that there's plenty of good reason to believe that's what happened to this one. Certainly it's the only one that's got evidence to back it up, you know, that's got precedent to back it up. Wouldn't you say, okay, let's take a look at our practices for training pilots with hypoxia. Let's take a look at our practices for how we refill and refit the crew oxygen. Let's take a look at, you know, how we manage the maintenance of our masks. Wouldn't you want airlines to just start doing that because the possibility exists that this has now happened twice? Wouldn't you say, hey, maybe we need to pay attention to this? But you don't hear anyone saying it, because the only person actually is coming out and saying, look, I think this is what happened to Malaysia 370 is Christine Negroni.
You need more pull, Christine. You got to put your foot down somewhere and tell them, no, this is how we're doing it.
I put my foot down and I wrote a book.
Christine Negroni is the author of The Crash Detectives, Investigating the World's Most Mysterious Air Disasters. The book is fascinating, covers a lot more than what we've talked about today. ChristineNegroni.com for more information about Christine. You can follow her on Twitter at CNegroni. Thank you so much for the time, and I look forward to speaking with you again.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
News is next. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN.